You're listening to the DC Real Estate Podcast, the podcast where we focus exclusively on all things local to the DMV area. Local investors, local knowledge, local experts. Our journey starts now.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Welcome to the first episode of the DC Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Russell Brazil. I'm an associate real estate broker with Arlo Real Estate and a buy and hold real estate investor. And I'm here with Jack Seiden of DMV Flippers.
Hi, I'm Jack Seiden, owner of DMV Flippers. I am also a real estate investor, mostly fix and flips. We have a rental, just kind of all around investor, real estate nerd, overall idiot, but definitely real estate nerd. And I'm really excited to do this. This is something me and Russell have talked about doing for almost 2 years, right?
Yeah, we've been talking about this for a long time. We're really excited to talk about local real estate. There's tons of podcasts out there that talk about real estate in sort of large, ambiguous terms. We really want to get down to the nitty gritty, what neighborhoods in DC we're investing in and why, what are the problems or the pros in certain neighborhoods, what, you know, talk about specific asset classes and types of properties.
And it should really feel like, you know, me and Russell are really good friends in real life, like just your friends at a bar talking about real estate. Hopefully we're a little bit more knowledgeable about real estate than the average person. Probably not about life. If we ever give life advice on this podcast, please don't take it. You know, hopefully it's kind of that vibe of just two friends talking at a bar, but you know, we're actually out there doing the real estate stuff. And, also I want to point out, this is now, do you know this? There are two of us in this room, the most listened to episode of a DC real estate podcast, ever in history. Two minutes in. This is number one. We're number one. So if anyone wants to sponsor us, we are officially the number one most listened to DC real estate podcast. Number one.
And actually, we will have advertising opportunities available in future episodes. If you're interested in that, email us at info@dcrealestatepodcast.com.
All right. So, Russell, so the market has been absolutely insane for the last 2 years. So what do you see happening in the next year or two? Where is the market going to head from here?
Yeah. So what I'm thinking is I think we're starting to see a normalizing of the market. 100%. Normally, we have a little slowdown around the 4th of July and a slowdown in August. Last year, we did not see that at all. We just had the hot spring market extend straight through the summer, fall, winter. But I think we've seen a little bit of slowdown here in August. Not that the market's not hot, but it's sort of at a normal range, which is kind of a relief, to be honest.
What's the, when the fireworks go up, the sales go down?
Yep, that's a definitely a quote we use in real estate sales quite a bit. What it means is, if we have listings on the market in the spring, we really want to try to get them, you know, sold by the 4th of July. Because DC, everyone goes on vacation in DC in July and August. So the city sort of empties out and we have a lot less buyers on the market. And so we sort of hit a lull in the market until we get to Labor Day.
Except for me. They canceled my trip to Canada. So I'm still here with you.
Yeah. So what happened? Your test expired.
No, it was just like one of those deals where like, I don't know what would have happened, but we were sitting in the airport. They had canceled. We weren't going to get into our connecting flight, and we had the test. It was like, I just didn't want to end up like, we probably would have been fine, but in like some purgatory in Toronto, because we wasn't a direct flight in like Toronto and another country. And so we decided to not do it, which ended up being a smart decision because my mom and sister were supposed to fly out the next 2 days later, and their flight got completely canceled. It was just Air Canada was a mess. Testing was a mess. It just like, it was probably not the best idea to do in the middle of a pandemic, but we thought it'd be over by now. So we didn't think we'd be back to.
Well, I think we all thought we'd be out of coronavirus by now, but it only seems like it's about to pick up and get worse with this Delta variant.
Get vaccinated.
But it certainly doesn't seem to have had a negative effect on the real estate market.
No, COVID's been the best thing. Well, I don't know. I mean, depends on if you're an investor or a. COVID has made the market what it is, right? I mean, to some extent.
I mean, certainly it's we already were in a low inventory environment, and prior to COVID, we were operating with about 6 or 7 weeks of inventory here in DC, and that got cut in half with COVID. So, not enough inventory, too many buyers. Probably the number of buyers that were in the market was higher than normal because of COVID,
and totally shifted asset classes too. So. Everyone wanted to move to a single family or even townhome, right? So the condos actually, you can get a condo for, some of them were 20% off?
Yeah, condos, I don't know if they were 20% off, but definitely like 5 to 10% off condo prices from 2019. Condos were the coldest asset class over the last year and a half, and still remain cold to this day. They're starting to pick up a little bit, I believe. I listed a condo a couple weeks ago, and I did sell it in, you know, I think 4 days, but that was sort of unusual. I've got another condo listed. I'm like 2 or 3 months on the market now, and that's, you know, that's getting no action.
Make Russ an offer.
Yeah. Would love to get that thing sold.
So do you think that that's something like, because you could say, okay, they're undervalued, it's a good asset, and go back up. But, you know, if this remote work thing, even if it's not 5 days a week, if people aren't going, you know, people only need to commute 1 or 2 days a week, and so they don't need to be as downtown as much, does that? And I think people also just discovered the outdoors, I think, has been something people realized during the pandemic, that outside is nice. Do you think that is a permanent devaluation of condos, or is it going to bounce right back to?
I don't think it's permanent. I do think people are going to want different things in condos. You know, maybe larger spaces, condos with outdoor spaces. But
I think studios can be permanently hit, and maybe smaller one bedrooms.
Yeah, I mean, studios are always going to be hard. They're hard to sell now, or prior to COVID, they're hard to sell. They're always going to have their place, but you know, condos that are multi levels are always going to sell a little bit better than sort of your apartment style one level ones. I think part of the problem with condos was not only were they small and sort of in confined spaces, but they're in these neighborhoods where you want to live in Logan Circle, right? So you can walk to 14th Street bars and restaurants. And with all the bars and restaurants closed, there was no incentive to live in a neighborhood like that and pay a huge premium to do so.
I'll tell you, I was in Adams Morgan Friday night. They were definitely not, the bars were definitely open there.
Yeah.
I think that'll be interesting to see. I'm also really fascinated by kind of like, this is another theory of mine, how remote work is going to affect, and this is probably bigger than any specific like DC, this is more of a trend, but you know, I have a bunch of friends who live alone, they're teleworking, you get really lonely. And so I've wondered, is that going to lead to more, I don't exactly know what it would be, intergenerational living. There's always been this thought of like dorm room or retirement communities for adults, you know, kind of communal living. Maybe the people that are going to have roommates for longer, even if they don't need them, because I know another trend, especially in the DC area, is people are getting married later. Like, it really makes me wonder kind of with this remote work, because you're going to spend a lot of time by yourself, how that changes the market as a whole.
I mean, definitely the remote work aspect is changing what types of assets people are looking for, because people are really looking for home offices right now. Really easy example of this is at my house, me and my wife are both working from home, and suddenly we didn't have enough space for us to both be working from home. Therefore, I bought this office space that we were in here right now recording. So I needed about 800 square feet more space
You just wanted a man cave.
Well, you know, I've got some man cave like things in here, but
I wonder that, obviously, for like, that's obviously true for people who are married, but even like, I do wonder, like, do you want to sit in a studio condo by yourself for hours a day? Like, I do wonder if it leads to more, more kind of interesting living arrangements. So people I think need to be with people. And it seems like that's definitely a problem.
Yeah. Back out of this, because there's certainly going to be some companies that don't go back into a workplace.
Or it's 1 day a week.
But they're certainly going to be certain things lost in that, right? Just the ability to dialogue with coworkers. So I wonder if we'll see sort of it had been starting to become kind of popular over the last like 5 years, those co-working spaces. I wonder if we'll see more of those or less of those going forward, because it seems like a natural sort of way for people to be in an office space working without having to pay for actual office
space. Maybe condos that have a co-working space built in, like newer condos, that's interesting.
You know, I've definitely seen some of the newer condo and apartment buildings that have some interesting amenities like a business center, but I've seen a couple that had like podcast studios in them, which was kind of interesting. So I wonder if newer builds, if we'll see sort of that. But on the other hand, I imagine developers want to maximize every square foot. So did they want to put square footage towards something they could sell as opposed to making an amenity?
For sure. So obviously the $1 million question, and I think this is more complicated, which we'll get into the weeds. The market has obviously been white hot. Is it going to go up, down? I know we've already talked about some of the comps, you know, very minorly from April are kind of not, or actually already endgame. We're talking a couple $1,000, but are actually down from April to, you know, August, September. Again, you're talking about rounding errors, but they're certainly not going up. It seems like prices have stagnated. Is that They're going to go back up, or they're going to keep stagnating, or they're going to go down.
So I think we're sort of hitting a natural cycle now. So I think July and August, we would normally see a little bit of a softness in the market, a little bit of slowdown. I think we're seeing that. And I think once we get past Labor Day, it's really going to be illustrative, because after Labor Day, the market would, in a normal year, typically pick up, and we would start to see, you know, maybe not as many bidding wars as we would see in the spring, but we would start to see houses get 3 and 4 and 5 offers again. So if that starts happening after this Labor Day, I think we're going to be see what just a normal real estate cycle over the next year. Now, if the softness in August extends into September, you know, maybe that's just a correction of us going to see a few months of softness, you know, as we recover from, you know, the insanity of this last year and a half.
And I think it's going to be very market specific. So I would assume DC and its entering suburbs, so DC, Northern Virginia, PG, Montgomery. I mean, I don't think we're going to see these 15-20% year over year. I mean, that's over, and it may have squeezed enough juice out that you're down to 3 or 5%. But I think it'll continue to see growth in the entering suburbs, right? I think that and it may be, again, maybe 3-5%. I think the days of getting 10-20 are, I want to say over, it really only lasted for a year or two. Yeah. It's going to go back to a normal market. But they should be fine. I do worry a little bit as you go further and further out, an hour, 2 hours from DC, some of these really outlying exurbs, you know, what they do over the next few years, just because they went up so much as a percentage. And I mean, again, a lot of it really does come back down to what you think the working situation is, right? I guess if people are all working from home, yeah, you can live in Washington County, Eastern Shore, Carroll County, but if you have to go back into work, those might be.
Definitely with DC, though, with the level of like high professionalism that we have across our industries, it seems like in our market, at least, employers are making employees go back to the office. My wife's returning to the office. All of my friends are. I think in sort of secondary, tertiary markets where you have a lot of these companies that maybe don't have quite as much money or aren't making quite as many profits, we may see an elimination of office space and more permanent work from home. But it seems like here, at least is the case, bosses want their employees in the office.
So how do you think that affects our really outlying suburbs when you go really far out, an hour, 2 hours from the city? Some people move there because they didn't have to commute in. Does that affect those markets?
You know, it's a good question. So I don't really know what kind of effect we'll see in sort of
Northern Frederick.
You know, I'm thinking like Frederick, Fredericksburg, you know, maybe even people that have been buying out at, you know, in Rehoboth or Beach and out that way. Because the beaches have been quite on fire too during this.
There's a lot of Eastern Shore thing. Yeah.
Yeah. People have been working their jobs right from the beachfront condos. So like beachfront condos went up quite a bit during this. I mean, Frederick was already going up pretty steadily. It probably experienced, I would think, in 20 and 21, slightly above average appreciation.
I think it definitely outpaced the entering suburbs, except for maybe Northern Virginia. It definitely outpaced Montgomery. PG was pretty hot, but like, yeah. It definitely outpaced Montgomery, which it usually does.
So I could definitely see that flattening off or even coming down a little bit when we go that far out. But yeah, I don't really see it in the inner rings.
No, the inner ring is fine. There's too much demand.
Montgomery County, Fairfax County, Arlington. The buyers just have so much money in these areas that.
So that's one of the things me and Russell love about telling the market, what is the price to, you know, average income ratio. And DC, when you look at it that way, I mean, it's not cheap, but it's, what are we trading about? 5, 5.5 to 1?
It's about 4.5 to 5, depending on, you know, specific neighborhoods.
And that's maybe a little bit above average. I think the average is like 4 or something. I don't remember.
Yeah. So the national average is about 4. We're right in line with, metro areas that you wouldn't necessarily consider expensive.
I think like Denver is more expensive, around the same. New Orleans is around the same.
Yeah, Denver's like 6 times earnings. Seattle's like 6 times earnings.
Seattle's like 10 or 11. San Francisco, Seattle, LA, those are all like double digits.
Yeah.
I think Vancouver's like 15 to 1. Some of those West Coast cities are insane. When you look at San Francisco, I think it's like 10 or 11 to 1. So it's essentially, when you adjust for salary, we are half the price of San Francisco.
And what we're saying here, guys, is so the salaries in DC are particularly high. So in DC proper, the median household income is about $120,000. In Montgomery County, it's about $110,000. The same in a lot of the other suburbs. So we'll take Montgomery County as a really good example. It's about $110,000 median household income, and the average home sells for about $525,000. So it's right around 5 times income is the price for housing in Montgomery County, Maryland. We look at Boston. Boston's got a median household income of only about $90,000. And I think their median home price is about 650. So they're trading at like seven and a half times earnings in Boston, making it a less affordable market than here. So I always find this is a really useful metric when we're comparing what we are like here in the DC area to other metros. We're really affordable being around five times earnings, while San Francisco and New York are 10, 11, 12 times earnings.
And, you know, I'd have to look this up, but no, it depends on how you define this. But if like any world-class city, so DC, LA, San Francisco, New York, like, you know, I don't know exactly, that's a vague definition, but, you know, a city that has like all the amenities, we're probably one of the cheapest, not only in the country, but a lot of those European are a lot more. I mean, you know, I think people, I guess like people hate DC, the incomes here are really high. And so that like, and our prices are, again, I guess to go back to the point, relatively not that expensive. And so DC is actually in a certain way, kind of a, I don't want to say a bargain because it's definitely expensive, but, you know, if you want to live in a world-class city and you know, you want your paycheck to go a long way, DC is actually not a horrible place to live.
Well, it's actually one of the reasons I moved here over 15 years ago was I was living in Boston, where I'm originally from. And I was looking at moving jobs, and I kept seeing that all the jobs in DC for the equivalent, you know, same equivalent jobs in DC were paying 15 to 20% more than they were paying in Boston. And then I looked at the cost of housing, and DC was one of the, you know, it's an expensive city, but it's cheaper than Boston. So I was able to come here, make more money, and buy more house for that money here.
My sister just went through the same thing. She saw that the housing was cheaper in DC and she can make more money. And you know what she decided?
She went to Boston.
She went to Boston. She said, I'd like to pay more. I'd like to make less money and pay more.
Yeah.
But Boston's a cool city. Actually, I think I'm going to go there maybe next week.
I mean, it's pretty nice about 7 months out of the year. And, you know,
well, that's one of them. I'm going next week.
4 or 5 months out of the year, it's completely miserable. And that's why Bostonians are the way they are.
That's why it's not the alcoholism.
Well, when you have when you have long, you know, 5 month winters, that's going to contribute to the alcoholism. That's how we deal with it.
That's an interesting. Like, I do wonder if someone should do a study. Like, if the colder your cities, I'm sure it's true. Like, the more alcoholics you have, like you think about all the cities that are like known for beer, like Milwaukee. Well, that gets cold. Like all those Rust Belt cities. I do wonder if there's some correlation.
I always think about it too. When we're in the winter time here, like it. It stays light a little bit longer, maybe an hour longer than what I was used to growing up. So, like, they just have less light up there, too, on top of it.
Does everyone have seasonal, what's the depression, sad in Boston?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to call it. Affective disorder. It's hard to call it seasonal there because they're all just assholes all year round.
What's that, AAD? Assholes all year round? Yeah. AAD? all right. What are some areas that you think, again, it's all very expensive, but are relatively speaking, good values, not even necessarily for investors, but just if you had clients who said, I'm looking for something that's maybe not totally, you know, there's still some upside that's not totally.
Yes. Yeah, so some of the neighborhoods that I like that get upside right off the bat are all going to be sort of in the same price range. I really like Riggs Park over by the Fort Totten Metro, the Brentwood neighborhood of
DC.
Oh,
wait. Do we know someone who has a house there?
Who has a house in Riggs Park?
No, in Brentwood.
Oh, well, yeah, we got a flip going on in Brentwood. Jack picked it up just when we closed on a few weeks ago.
I think like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So if you think it's undervalued, you should let me know and I will sell it to you at a good price.
Well, I gladly paid the price that you bought it for.
It's a good price.
I don't think I would pay the price that we're going to sell it for.
No. But it is. This is something we talk about. One of the last neighborhoods. So something we talked about. There are now, I think, honestly, maybe three now, because I think like Brightwood's getting into the mid to high sevens. Left west of the river, where you can get a row home under seven. It's basically the Fort Totten Riggs Park area, maybe Tacoma Brightwood, but not really.
Yeah, Tacoma is such a small neighborhood, though. There's really not like there's never anything for sale there.
Well, I'm kind of saying Tacoma Brightwood, yeah. Kind of that whole kind of like very upper northwest. But, you know, west of
but Brightwood is basically the same price as that Petworth was four years ago.
High sevens. And then Fort Totten's below seven. Brentwood's about seven. Carver Langston's about seven. And that's about it.
And you can get something that's like not fully rehabbed in Riggs Park, like in the 500s. That would be
a good deal.
You know, perfectly livable or rentable. And if you can pay, you know, $550 for something in the city, that's a, you know, an appreciating neighborhood, that seems like a no-brainer to buy.
I mean, yeah, because pretty much, I think this time next year, yeah, you're going to be paying west of the river, you're going to be paying in the eights. I think that's where this is headed. That just if you want to live west of the river and at row home, you're paying in the 800s. I think that's like,
well, you know, I was having this conversation with one of my clients not that long ago that we closed a deal a few weeks ago in DuPont Circle. Really, really awesome four unit property. And we paid a lot of money for it.
Like 1.1, 1.2?
$1,980,000.
Doesn't seem like, so almost 2 mil.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the conversation I was having with that client was, I believe over the next decade, sort of these downtown corridor neighborhoods, DuPont, Logan, U Street, Capitol Hill, I think they're all going to become what I've been calling Manhattanized. I think the prices are going to go up to such levels in these neighborhoods. Like we're going to be seeing even entry level condos, you know, in 800, 900. And, you know, we're not going to see row houses below 2 million, even cheap ones. I think that the prices in those downtown corridor neighborhoods are going to explode and just become, you know, so normal everyday people cannot buy there. That's just where the wealthy are going to live, or the people that have owned, you know, since when they bought them before that.
And then one of the areas I really like is, and I'm going to extend this out a little bit, but like kind of, I guess, Georgia Ave, Silver Spring up to maybe Wheaton. I feel like they're all still good deals. I think Silver Spring could become Bethesdaized, where like Bethesda has gotten so expensive, like it's always been expensive, but so expensive that like the next tier down, if you want to live, like I think it's going to be a big thing, especially as millennials age into having children, you want something that's urbanized, walkable, single family. I think that's going to be a big trend over the next decade. Close to the city. And Silver Spring, I mean, you can still get a really nice house. Like walking to the metro is going to sound, this whole podcast, if you're not from this area, is going to sound insane, but like for well under $1 million, and whereas Bethesda would be 3 million. So if you think of it that way, there's a lot of room for, I could see Bethesda going to 4 and some of these Silver Spring things maybe in a decade being in the high 1s to 2. Even as you get further out, like Woodmore, Four Corners, you can get stuff in the 5s in Woodmore, Four Corners.
I mean, even some of the neighborhoods over there, like Forest Glen, for instance, probably over the next 5 years, that's going to have Rockville equivalent pricing. Right. It's going to push up in price point to those.
It's probably just, be above Rockville given its location at some point. I mean, it's further south.
It's got other things that Rockville has other things that that area doesn't have. So the further west is always going to be more expensive, I think. But I think that it's going to be – I think it's going to push up in price point quite
Wheaton's
a bit.
Still good. You can get a good house in Wheaton under 5.
Yeah.
Metro.
Decent restaurants.
Yeah, they have a good food scene. They're starting to build up there.
They don't really have like nightlife or bars, but that could come.
What do you think of Baltimore? That's always – that always comes back to
– you know – Baltimore, I think, is experiencing a bigger slowdown than D.C.
And for sure. You can see the inventory.
So I think they're really going back to normal. And normal there could be 60, 90, 120 days to sell an appropriately priced property. You know, sort of the hotness in our market was completely justified. I don't know if it was justified in these other markets in Baltimore being one of them.
I think Baltimore, I believe, had either the most or second biggest decline in inventory in the whole country, and now it's kind of coming back down. But I think Baltimore's another, again, I just keep coming back to, I think the remote work thing is really fascinating. I could see it going either way for a lot of these West Belt cities. So you can make an argument Baltimore, if people are going into work once or twice a day, is like a great, perfectly situated to be, hey, you know, the commute to DC is not great, but I can do it once or twice a week and I can get way more for my money. You can make that argument. But the other argument I've read, and this is, Baltimore will always have some, I think, floor because it is close to DC, but especially when you get into Cleveland, Detroit, all these declining cities, as much as they've declined, they still have multiple huge businesses there, right? They have, I don't know, Under Armour, Leg Mason, Black & Decker, if you're in Detroit, the car companies, and people were working there. And if you're a young person working there, you lived in Fells Point, you know, Canton, Federal Hill, whatever it was. But if you don't have to go into the office anymore, why live in any of these West Belt cities, right? Why not move to the beach somewhere? Why not move to some low tax Sun Belt state? And so I could see that also happening too. So I think Baltimore is really interesting. I could see it going either way.
Yeah, I could definitely see Baltimore being very susceptible to price declines over the next year. Just because we got such a big pop there during COVID. I think that's got to come back to normal. You know, they've still got a declining population. They don't have a great job space. If you have a good job in the area, you typically don't even live in Baltimore, even in the cool areas. You move out to Howard County, you live in Ellicott City, and you live in Columbia, or you go to Anne Arundel County. you just don't have a lot of high income people living in the city.
I know they have the CPRA. Is that what it's called in Columbia? That's another good area. You still got a decent deal in Columbia.
Yeah. Columbia is really nice. It's affordable. The CPRA fee does add an extra layer of cost of living there. But, you know, I always think of Columbia being somewhat similar to Silver Spring and Rockville, just your taxes are a little bit higher, but your home's a little bit more affordable. You know, probably a good place for entry-level investing, too, in terms of, like, being in a low-risk environment. In terms of owning a rental.
I mean, you can get a townhome there in the threes, I think.
Yeah.
There's some nice townhomes there, decent HOAs.
I mean, if I'm going to spend in the threes, and honestly, I'd rather be in, you know, for like $325 or rather own something in Columbia versus, say, even Burtonsville, which is in Montgomery County.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and, you know, the one thing I've started to think too, like if you're in that 3 to 4 price point, it depends obviously on the age of the condos, but like I do, it's something obviously we saw with the Surfside, but beyond buildings collapsing. I think we're seeing this. There's a building that we both know in Rockville that's having the Americana building that's having problems. Like some of these stuff that's in the threes, something people have to watch out for as they age and things, those HOAs are going to keep going up. And, you know, some of these buildings have huge deferred maintenance and that's going to obviously, if every year they're upping your HOA a couple $100, that's a real problem. So I've started to think if I can get a townhome in the threes that, and I just picked one up at 300 exactly. I will talk about that in a second. That's a much better way than a condo where the HOA fees, if it's an older building, are very unpredictable.
Yeah, particularly these really high-rise buildings. So the Americana Center is, I don't know what, got to be 30 floors, maybe more.
Yeah, it's like 70 years old now.
So those buildings always seem to not age as well and always have a lot of deferred maintenance. And then whenever they got to revamp them, you know, revamping a 30, 40, you know, story building is extremely costly.
Yeah. Yes.
When you're talking about like a building that's more like 3 or 4 floors, you don't have any sort of logistical issues with like how you're refacing the 30th floor. Right. So the low rise buildings always tend to age better, not have these exploding fees. So I like, you know, Washingtonian Center in Gaithersburg, another example of that where really tall aging building and the fees have just gotten out of hand as they needed to maintain the building and those costs have shot up quite a bit.
That's another area I like. And I actually bought a townhome there. So clearly I do like it. It's kind of like, there is some either, and depends on what you're looking for. There's some condos. They're probably now in the mid to high threes, frankly. Some townhomes, one that I picked up in the mid threes. And then some bigger townhomes in the fives and sixes, but kind of, Crown Farm, but a little bit like right outside the border, a couple blocks from Crown, these older 90s stuff. They're good deals.
You're basically buying a property in Crown, essentially, without having to pay Crown prices.
And interesting, if you get most of these stuff in the 90s, so I think like Coverley is kind of one of the areas. I think that's like the subdivision name. You're not actually technically in the city of Gaithersburg anymore. You come out to unincorporated Montgomery County. It actually has a Rockville mailing address.
So you get lower tax rate.
You have no city tax, which my mom doesn't like because she works for the city of Gaithersburg, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, it's certainly, so I live in Crown and probably the thing I least like about it is the fact that I have to pay city of Gaithersburg taxes.
But you're helping my mom. That doesn't make you feel better. Does that make you feel better?
I'm not exactly sure what I'm getting for those extra taxes, to be honest.
The great service the city provides, no?
Yeah, I mean, we have our own police force. I don't know why I need that in addition to Montgomery County Police.
Well, it's a very crime-ridden area, that Crown Farm.
Yeah.
it's always something going on down there.
We did have that guy last year that the police were trying to catch who ran into one of the garages over there.
They said it was a balding guy with a red goatee.
Yeah. So we mentioned earlier one of the neighborhoods we like is Brentwood, and you get a flip going on there. So let's talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, so we picked it up through a relatively well-known wholesaler in the D.C. area. We paid, and that's actually interesting. But to get to some other time, but we paid $430 for it. So the way it works, and you know, this is, I'll get very into the weeds because I always have people asking me, you know, how do you flip? And you know, we have a couple of big advantages going for us that, you know, make it, I would say, very hard for most people to flip in this market. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So the margins have squeezed considerably in the last 2 years that it, we used to be able to pick up flips just buying directly off the MLS for years. And have enough margin to
make 50
to 75,000 pretty easily. And that is all almost all but disappeared over the last 2 years.
So what we did is we picked up the 430, and this is – we'll run about – now, I'll get to the difference between me and other people in a second, but we were going to run about $70,000 in overhead. So that's taxes and liquidation, real estate fees, holding costs. So by the time we even start the project, we're in for five. People really don't understand just how much your just soft costs add up. We'll probably run the reno for about – I'm thinking about maybe in about 120. And we'll probably sell it for around at least seven. That's $80,000 profit. That's awesome. Now, I'll break that down. A couple things that we have. So first of all, I almost, not almost exclusively, but I like focusing on post-World War II brick row homes. They just tend to be built better. They have less problems or smaller. I mean, one of the saving graces of this house is that it's relatively small. It's 1,500 square feet, two full baths. While it is definitely, you know, needs a complete rehab, it's not, you know, it's brick. There's not decaying wood. Foundation's good. Already has central air. Central air is a big $20,000-$30,000 expense.
Modern wiring, modern plumbing.
Yeah, and if there's a problem, it's built like people can fix it. Like a lot of these old houses, you run into like these weird. Like I once had a house that we did where the foundation wasn't a problem. The foundation was fine. It was made of clay, terracotta clay, which you can imagine why you wouldn't make a foundation of clay. And the guy said like it's fine. It's to be here for the next 100 years, but like please don't ever use any power tools down here because it's clay. And so. You know, so I really like these post-World War II brick row homes. But the thing I always get asked about this is like, you know, one of the big advantages we have is we're not using hard money. So I think we're probably safe for about $40,000 a deal not using hard money.
Probably not that much, 30? But, you know, 20, 25, 30 on if it's a more expensive and longer flip, could be up to 30.
And then we
but have definitely a minimum of 20 to 25 grand per flip we're saving by you not having to use hard money.
And then we probably save – our contractor's awesome. I'm not going to give you his name because I don't want to. But we probably save – I don't know. I'm thinking at this point, I think we're probably saving 40 over what like a retail – like a first time. You know, at a certain point, you have a relationship. You know, he knows I'm good for it. He knows I'm not going to stiff him. Or at this point, you know, have a very good working relationship. So, but I think, you know, he would charge another client 40 grand more. So right there, that's – $70,000 in profit.
Well, you know, one thing I always think that's interesting with contractor costs when we're talking to other investors is they end up in one of two camps. Either their renovation costs are so cheap that there's no way that it is being done by a licensed contractor, or they're so expensive. It's like, how are you making profit?
They're not.
Paying that. Yeah.
I mean, I suspect in the market right now there were three things. First of all, the flipping market, I believe it's down 75% year over year, right?
Yeah, so
that's nearly a wipeout of an industry.
That was, I think that was in 2020. It was down 75% from 2019. I don't know what the 2021 stat is yet.
So I think the flipping, you have a couple of different things going on. I think you have there are still people like me who are making out. I think fewer and fewer, but there are still people who are able to do their one or two flips a year. And if you're making six figures on a flip, hey, you get one or two a year, you're doing a pretty good living for yourself, which is fine. But I think a lot of people are losing money. I think people don't tell you when they lose money. They tell you when they make money. I talked to one hard money guy who said most of his clients, if they make 10 grand, they're happy. I'm like, okay, well, that's just not worth time, effort, risk.
No.
And then I do think there's a lot of, you know, if you want to use unlicensed labor, not pull permits, you know, put lipstick on a pig, you can make money. Obviously, I love what I do. I'm not trying to go to jail for this. I'd like to do things on the up and up. And also, you know, we try to provide a, you know, you always have to remember some family's going to pay, well, way too much for this house, going to live there, maybe going to raise their kids there. And you want to give them a good house, which I think, unfortunately, not everyone shares. So I think there is, to the extent people are still doing it, probably, I would imagine there are not that many people still doing it, well, it's not arrogant, but like the right way and ethically left in the market at this point.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear like some people look at this house that we have where there's about $120,000 renovation budget. Literally, we'll hear someone say like, oh, that's a $75,000 rehab. Like, well,
no.
Like, no. Like, so it's not possible.
You just said that. Yeah. No, $120 is relatively affordable. I think someone who is new in the business could easily spend $150, $160.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that would be – if Ray – you know, because this is how contractors work, right? Was it all worried that I was going to stiff him or not pay my bills on time. You build that in, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's got no question that you're going to pay that bill, that you're not someone that's hard up for money, because you do hear about some of these contractors that are getting stiffed by guys. And I'm sure that they are padding their what they need to charge in order to cover being stiffed by a bunch of people.
It's all like, what's the thing? It's all what's your thing? Like all of life is just a risk, risk premium or something? What's you ever saying about that? It's like investing. Everything is just like some risk. You have some great quote. I'm going to butcher it.
I don't know what it is. No, hopefully I'll be able to figure it out what it is.
Life is just risk tolerance or risk premium.
I mean, I do talk about risk tolerance and risk premium.
Like when everyone's like, I have some. Because that's one thing I think investors really, really get wrong about like cap rates and stuff. The higher the cap rate, often the much higher risk of the deal. Like yes. A 5 cap, you're going to get 5 cap. If you get a 10 or 15 cap, it might be 10 or 15, but it also might be 0 or negative.
Yeah, so I say this a lot. Yield is a function of risk.
That's the quote. That's the quote. Okay.
Yield is a function of risk.
That's the quote.
The higher and higher your yield is, or the higher and higher your cap rate is, that is the market telling us that it is a riskier and riskier asset and or market. So a 10% cap rate property is inherently riskier than a 5% cap rate. The problem is that the novice investor gets the risk premium backwards. So they think more and more cash flow means safety. And no, it is the complete opposite. More and more of this cash flow is the market telling us is screaming and blinking red, risk, risk, risk.
Because, and we saw this during the, you know, what's happened in the last 2 years and the eviction moratorium and all this. The way rent works usually is you get all of it or nothing. It's not like you get 75% of your rent. Either the tenant pays on time or they don't pay at all. I mean, I guess maybe sometimes they pay half their rent, but for the most part, it's just, because people think of it as, oh, well, there's so much rent to cover. It's like, yeah, but if all of your tenants stop paying or enough percentage of them, you're bankrupt. And so, yeah, it's usually people are either going to pay or you're going to evict them. And yeah. I think those cheap assets, and we don't need to get into the politics of this or what people think or don't think, but at a certain point when you're an investor, you got to just look at the market. This eviction moratorium, I assume at some point will end, although who knows? But like now it's on the table. So that means the next economic crisis or the next
it'll happen again.
You know, whatever the situation is. Now it's probably, you know, obviously it depends on who's running the country, it depends on all that stuff, but it is now on the table in a way it wasn't before. So that has to be factored into your risk assessment of these cheaper properties, because I don't think this is the last time we're going to see that, even if it eventually does get lifted.
No, it's definitely not the last time we're going to see this. We'll definitely see it in the future. And it will probably be in situations that have nothing to do with healthcare. Just right, economic downturn, they will do an eviction moratorium again.
That's another thing we talk about, though, for everyone on the other side, everyone who talks about how, you know, we know a lot of people who, you know, there's another 2008 coming, there's another crash. For 8 different reasons, that's not true. I think people get 2008 wrong. There was actually way too much inventory. I think we were before it crashed up to about 8 months, normal market 6. And then during the crash, we get over a year.
Yeah, we got up to 15, 16 months inventory nationally, I think at one point during the collapse.
It's like 3
but,
now.
But even before prices started to decline, inventory was at a high level. So 6 months is what's considered in equilibrium of market between buyers and sellers. And what that means is if no new houses came on the market, if there's 6 months of inventory, that means it will take 6 months for every house on the market to sell. So what's considered an equal market is 6 months of inventory. If we have less than that, if we have 2, 3, 4 months of inventory, that's considered a seller's market where sellers are in charge. If we have 7 or 8 months of inventory, that's considered a buyer's market, and the buyers have more of the power in that situation. So prior to the crash,
I think it's 8 months or 9 months prior, yeah, before it happens.
Inventory was creeping up, and I think it went from 4 months to 8 or 9 months in a relatively, you know, short period of time, say 6 months, 9 months, it creeped up. But that's when inventory starts creeping up. That's when prices can decline, right? And that's what eventually did happen. And inventory went to hugely high levels, and then therefore prices declined a lot.
I always think it's underrated. I mean, yes, the fact that like a dog could walk into a bank in 06 and then give them a small loan. I mean, not a big loan because it was a dog, but they could probably get one with no docs. That obviously contributed, but I think the inventory is underrated. I think people think it was just about the loan situation when it definitely – had a lot with inventory too.
Yeah, so we were also during that buildup, we were overbuilding a lot, right? Because houses were worth a lot and builders saw that they could make tons of profit. And so they overbuilt during, 2000 to 2006.
And builders are aware of that now, so they're not overbuilding, which is
so now we have
for society, but you know.
Now we have the opposite problem though. For a decade now, so many builders went bankrupt, went out of business, or just started building less houses after the market collapsed.
Higher end, less entry level.
Yeah. So now we don't, after a decade of underbuilding, we don't have enough homes for the amount of people that need them.
And
this is going to be a decade long problem. This ain't fixed.
Labor. I mean, yeah. There's not enough supplies. You can't get a a fridge. How are you going to build a house if you can't get a fridge? Yeah. You know,
Enough labor to build the houses. There's not enough materials to build the houses. And builders just don't want to build. They don't want to take that risk. And so we are in a national inventory crisis because of the underbuilding of a decade. And it's going to take 10 or 15 years to work this out. And with no relief in sight on inventory, there's not going to be any sort of mass collapse.
But the other thing, my original point before we got on the tangent was people often like, I think people get into political debates and at a certain point that's irrelevant. You just have to look at like, it is what it is. And one of the things that on the other flip side of the eviction moratorium, the government is never going to let 2008 happen again. It will not be allowed to happen.
Nope.
They will like, what did you, they will freeze prices. They will say, you're not allowed to sell your house below this price. Like it will, we saw the foreclosure moratorium. It will never happen. Not only that, the banks actually, I think also screwed themselves in 08, right? By they foreclosed too much. I should have renegotiated some of these loans. They probably would have come out better ahead. They're not going to do that again. 2008 is, I mean, famous last words. I'm sure tomorrow there'll be some epic crash, but, like I feel like the situations involved, the government's not going to let happen. The banks are not going to let happen again. And I feel like that's actually an overrated risk in this market. Could prices decline? Yeah, possibly.
Absolutely.
Especially, I think DC's relatively safe, but some of these Boise, Spokane, some of those markets have got really, really hot, maybe. But you're not going to see a 25% nationwide collapse, I don't think.
Well, and that's where we're getting, right, getting back to a normal, healthy market means that, right, what's going on in San Francisco should be different than what's going on in Detroit or rural Oklahoma, right? Real estate should be affected by local supply and demand issues, local job growth, local income growth. And for too long, the real estate market has moved in lockstep across the country, either completely up or completely down together. And now we should start seeing a disjointing of that, and we should see local market conditions being the primary factor in what drives it. And luckily here in DC, DC has no lack of jobs. We have the highest incomes in the country.
And they have the government, which is going to go out of business.
Yeah. We've got 12% of our workforce is government employees. Another 12% are private sector tech workers, which I think a lot of people overlook. They forget that the backbone of the internet runs through Northern Virginia here.
I'm sure people in San Francisco would be very insulted by that, but.
Well, all West Coast internet activity runs through there. All the East Coast activity runs through here. But people don't think about DC being, you know, a big tech place with Google and Amazon, but we have plenty of Google and Amazon employees here.
Yeah. And I think,
a full 12% of our workforce.
And yeah, DC tends to be pretty recession proof, but yeah, I mean that was really fascinating. I do think it comes back to also like as like, I think again, I keep going back to the work situation, but what happened in the 2010s was like, there was all these superstar cities. You had these 10 cities, I don't know, DC, New York, LA, San Francisco, maybe Nashville, Denver, that really took all of the, not all the jobs, but the certain type of job, a certain type of person, a certain type of, you know, younger millennial. And so I think that's where everything kind of started to move in lockstep. But I think now there's, with a lot of remote work, and there are going to be jobs, options that are permanently remote, you're going to see markets just kind of behave in different ways, where it's actually historically not weird to see, you know, making this up, DC go up 10% in a year and, you know, Omaha go down 15%. Like that's actually shouldn't be weird historically. But that's been the case for the last decade plus, and I think you could see a reversion to the mean where, yeah, you see some markets that really do suffer some pretty hefty declines, other markets that, you know, continue to go up.
Well, yeah, I mean, historically, there are certain markets that are what we call cyclical, right? They go up in value, then they recede in prices a little bit, then go up, then recede. Baltimore. So like Baltimore is one of them, Phoenix, Las Vegas, those are very cyclical markets. But not every market operates like that. DC is a market that we don't shoot up.
Yeah, we don't get big booms.
We don't get big, huge booms like, say, San Francisco going up 25% in a year, which is not unheard of for them. We're much more of a steady market. And so we go up pretty steady. Sometimes we plateau, go up steady, plateau, but we don't really have rescissions in our prices.
And it does mean that if you're a first-time investor, I mean, obviously it's expensive, but let's kind of put that aside for a second. And it actually makes it a good market to invest in, because the problem when you're investing in a less stable market, you don't know really when you're buying in, right? Are you buying it at the top, at the bottom? It's hard to know. Whereas in DC, you can kind of plan out that if I buy in most of the metro area, it's going to be worth more in 4 or 5 years. I don't want to say it's like a rule of life because it's not always true. And we did see some pretty hefty declines here from like 08 to 12. We bounced back pretty quickly, but we bounced back. That was the other thing.
Yeah, we bounced back quickly, and we also didn't see the kind of declines that, you know, other markets, you know, Florida or California are experiencing.
But it makes it, weirdly, for a first-time investor, a relatively safe investment. Yeah, you're not going to get rich overnight, but you're also not going to get bankrupted.
Well, that sort of goes back into one of the earlier topics we were talking about, where what is the income-to-price ratio? So where DC is trading at about 5 times the income. If you were to think about the income to price ratio and think about it like a price to earnings ratio for a stock. So a stock that is trading at 30 times earnings is inherently a much riskier purchase than something trading at 5 times earnings, right?
For sure. So
if you think about our incomes here in relation to our housing prices creates a lower risk environment here. And if you just think about all the things about DC, everything about DC screams low risk, right? Stable jobs, high incomes, stable housing supply. The inability to build more housing here helps support our housing prices.
Yeah, and that's something I always look at when I'm looking at investments. Can they keep building? Now, because you do have these markets where what happens is, you know, especially like some of these markets, like let's say Texas, where they can build forever. And one of the things about DC is literally it's geographically, like it's not, you know, flat land where you can build forever. Eventually there's water, there's some elevation. How constrained is the supply? That's kind of one of the best ways to know.
Well, basically going east from here, you know, not everything's completely built out till we hit the Chesapeake Bay, but right, you can't build beyond the Chesapeake Bay. Like there's a natural border there, as there is in most of the coastal cities.
Yeah, and like PG and Anne Arundel, I mean, they're not PG's pretty much done. Anne Arundel's getting pretty built out. I would say the only parts of the metro area that you could see maybe having a little bit more is like maybe parts of Frederick, but Frederick's getting built out too. I feel like the in the next 4 or 5 years, they're going to build out Frederick County, and you're going to be like the next place to build is like, I don't know, Washington County. So if you're like Frederick South, like you're going to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Anyways, we've gone on a long time here, so I think we're going to be wrapping up. Thanks for coming on, Jack. And
Anytime.
Make sure to follow Jack. What's your Instagram?
At DMV Flippers. If you have any off-market deals, please send them to me. I will buy them.
Yep. And if you want to reach out to either of us, just hit us up at info@dcrealestatepodcast.com.
Oh, wait. Do you want to, if anyone has any listener questions they want to send in, should they send that in?
You got questions, send them into that address. We're happy to answer them. And thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the DC Real Estate Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to contact the hosts, reach out to them at info@dcrealestatepodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you access your podcasts.